Archie. That is the superintendent of the Air Force Academy, General Thomas Moorman, on the president's left, slightly behind him, escorting him to the platform.
I'm ready.
Order! Arms!
The introduction to the president will be by Lieutenant General Moorman. Hip hoorays from the cadet corps. After a spirited singing of the Air Force song under a Caribbean sea blue sky and a few cirro stratus clouds.
Mr. President, the great honor for us here at the Air Force Academy and for all the good people of this beautiful state of Colorado to have you here to address the graduating class of 1969. We are doubly fortunate that you brought with you the First Lady and your family. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
General Moorman, Governor Love, Senator Allet, Senator Dominick, General McConnell, Secretary Seaman, all of the distinguished guests on the platform, members of the graduating class, and this great audience here in Falcon Stadium. Before addressing the members of the graduating class, I would like to be permitted a personal word to the people of Colorado and to the people of this city. I want to thank you for the very warmly and gracious welcome you gave to me and the members of our family. I well remember the conversations that I had with General Eisenhower in the months before he died. He often reminisced about the past, and among his fondest memories were his visits to Colorado. These were some of the happiest days of his life. And yesterday, when we arrived in Colorado Springs, we stepped out of the aircraft. We breathed this wonderfully fresh air. We looked off across to the mountains 50 miles away. And as we stood there, we knew what he meant when he spoke of Colorado, its people, and also the climate, everything that all of you who live here know and love so much. And I should just like to give you one impression that shows you there is some continuity in history. Dwight David Eisenhower II, the grandson of General Eisenhower and his namesake, as he saw this beautiful country and looked to the mountains off to the distance, said, "Gee, this is great country." want you to know that I agree, and I congratulate the Air Force for having the good judgment to locate the Air Force Academy here in Colorado Springs. And one other personal note, I had the opportunity before coming to the stadium to take a tour of some of the campus facilities, and particularly the chapel. Now, there's been some controversy about that chapel. This is the first time that I've seen it. I'm not an architectural expert, but I think it's magnificent, and I think you can be very proud of that chapel at the Air Force Academy. And now, if I could address the members of the graduating class. For each of you and your parents and your countrymen, this is a moment of quiet pride. After years of study and training, you have earned the right to be saluted. But you are beginning your careers at a difficult time in military life. On a fighting front, you are asked to be ready to make unlimited sacrifice in a limited war. On the home front, you are under attack from those who question the need for a strong national defense, and indeed see a danger in the power of the defenders. You are entering the military service of your country when the nation's potential adversaries abroad have never been stronger, and when your critics at home have never been more numerous. It is open season on the armed forces. Military programs are ridiculed as needless, if not deliberate, waste. The military profession is derided in some of the so-called best circles of America. Patriotism is considered by some to be a backward fetish of the uneducated and the unsophisticated. Nationalism is hailed and applauded as a panacea for the ills of every nation except the United States of America. And this paradox of military power is a symptom of something far deeper that is stirring in our body politic. It goes beyond the dissent about the war in Vietnam. It goes behind the fear of the military-industrial complex. The underlying questions are really these. What is America's role in the world? What are the responsibilities of a great nation toward protecting freedom beyond its shores? Can we ever be left in peace if we do not actively assume the burden of keeping the peace? When great questions are posed, fundamental differences of opinion come into focus, and it serves no purpose to gloss over these differences or to try to pretend that they are mere matters of degree. Because there is one school of thought that holds that the road to understanding with the Soviet Union and Communist China lies through a downgrading of our own alliances and what amounts to a unilateral reduction of our arms in order to demonstrate our good faith. They believe that we can be conciliatory and accommodating only if we do not have the strength to be otherwise. They believe that America will be able to deal with the possibility of peace only when we are unable to cope with the threat of war. Those who think that way have grown weary of the weight of free world leadership that fell upon us in the wake of World War II. They argue that that the United States, is as much responsible for the tensions in the world as the adversaries we face. They assert that the United States is blocking the road to peace by maintaining its military strength at home and its defenses abroad. And if we would only reduce our forces, they contend, tensions would disappear and the chances for peace would brighten. America's powerful military presence on the world scene, they believe, make peace abroad improbable and peace at home impossible. Now, we should never underestimate the appeal of this isolationist school of thought. Their slogans are simplistic and powerful. Charity begins at home. Let's first solve our problems at home, and then we can deal with the problems of the world. This simple formula touches a responsive chord with many an overburdened taxpayer. And it would be easy for a president of the United States to buy some popularity by going along with the new isolationists. But I submit to you that it would be disastrous for our nation and the world. I hold a totally different view of the world, and I come to a different conclusion about the direction America must take. Imagine for a moment, if you will, what would happen to this world if America were to become a dropout in assuming the responsibility for defending peace and freedom in the world. As every world leader knows, and as even the most outspoken critics of America would admit, the rest of the world would live in terror. Because if America were to turn its back on the world, there would be peace that would settle over this planet. But it would be the kind of peace that suffocated freedom in Czechoslovakia. The danger to us has changed, but it has not vanished. We must revitalize our alliances, not abandon them. We must rule out unilateral disarmament, because in the real world it won't work. If we pursue arms control as an end in itself, we will not achieve our end. The adversaries in the world are not in conflict because they are armed. They are armed because they are in conflict and have not yet learned peaceful ways to resolve their conflicting national interests. And the aggressors in this world are not going to give the United States a period of grace into which to put our domestic house in order. Just as the crises within our society cannot be put on a back burner until we resolve the problem of Vietnam. The most successful solutions that we can possibly imagine for our domestic programs will be meaningless if we're not around to enjoy them. Nor can we conduct a successful piece of policy abroad if our society is at war with itself at home. There is no advancement for Americans at home in a retreat from the problems of the world. I say that America has a vital national interest in world stability, and no other nation can uphold that interest for us. We stand at a crossroad in our history. We shall reaffirm our destiny for greatness, or we shall choose instead to withdraw into ourselves. The choice will affect far more than our foreign policy. It will determine the quality of our lives. A nation needs many qualities, but it needs faith and confidence above all. Skeptics do not build societies. The idealists are the builders. And only societies that believe in themselves can rise to their challenges. Let us not then pose a false choice between meeting our responsibilities abroad and meeting the needs of our people at home. We shall meet both, or we shall meet neither. That is why my disagreement with the skeptics and the isolationists is fundamental. They have lost the vision indispensable to great leadership. They observe the problems that confront us, they measure our resources, and then they despair. When the first vessel set out from Europe for the New World, these men would have weighed the risks, and they would have stayed behind. When the colonialists on the eastern seaboard started across the Appalachians to the unknown reaches of the Ohio Valley, these men would have counted the cost, and they would have stayed behind. Our current exploration of space makes the point vividly. Here is testimony to man's vision and to man's courage. The journey of the astronauts is more than a technical achievement. It is a reaching out of the human spirit. It lifts our sight. It demonstrates that magnificent conceptions can be made real. They inspire us, and at the same time, they teach us true humility. What could bring home to us more the limitations of the human scale than the hauntingly beautiful picture of our Earth seen from the moon? When the first man stands on the moon next month, every American will stand taller because of what he has done, and we should be proud of this magnificent achievement. We will know then that every man achieves his own greatness by reaching out beyond himself. And so it is with nations. When a nation believes in itself, as Athenians did in their golden age, as Italians did in the Renaissance, that nation can perform miracles. Only when a nation means something to itself can it mean something to others. That is why I believe a resurgence of American idealism can bring about a modern miracle. And that modern miracle is a world order of peace and justice. And I know that every member of this graduating class is in that sense an idealist. However, I must warn you that in the years to come, you may hear your commitment to America's responsibility in the world derided as a form of militarism. It is important that you recognize that straw man issue for what it is, the outward sign of a desire by some to turn America inward and to have America turn away from greatness. I am not speaking about those responsible critics who reveal waste and inefficiency in our defense establishment, who demand clear answers on procurement problems, who want to make sure a new weapon system will truly add to our defense. On the contrary, you should be in the vanguard of that movement. Nor do I speak of those with sharp eyes and sharp pencils who are examining our post-Vietnam planning with other pressing national priorities in mind. I count myself as one of those. But as your commander-in-chief, I want to relay to you, as future officers of our armed forces, some of my thoughts on these great issues of national moment. I worked closely with President Eisenhower for 8 years. I know what he meant when he said, "We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex." Many people conveniently forget that he followed that warning with another. We must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite. And we sometimes forget that in that same farewell address, President Eisenhower spoke of the need for national security. He said, "A vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction." And I say to you, my fellow Americans, let us never forget those wise words of one of America's greatest leaders. The American defense establishment should never be a sacred cow. But on the other hand, the American military should never be anybody's scapegoat. America's wealth is enormous, but it's not unlimited. It's not limitless. Every dollar available in the federal government has been taken from the American people in taxes. And a responsible government has a duty to be prudent when it spends the people's money. There is no more justification for wasting money on unnecessary military hardware than there is for wasting it on unwarranted social programs. And there can be no question that we should not spend unnecessarily for defense. But we must also not confuse our priorities. The question I submit in defense spending is a very simple one. How much is necessary? The President of the United States is the man charged with making that judgment. After a complete review of our foreign and defense policies, I have submitted requests to the Congress for military appropriations. Some of these are admittedly controversial. These requests represent the minimum I believe essential for the United States to meet its current and long-range obligations to itself and to the free world. I have asked only for those programs and those expenditures that I believe are necessary to guarantee the security of this country and to honor our obligations. And I will bear the responsibility for those judgments. Now, I do not consider my recommendations infallible. But if I have made a mistake, I pray that it is on the side of too much and not too little. If we do too much, it will cost us our money. If we do too little, it may cost us our lives. Mistakes in military policy today can be irretrievable. Time lost in this age of science can never be regained. America had months in order to prepare and to catch up in order to wage World War I. We had months and even years in order to catch up so that we could play a role in winning World War II. When a war can be decided in 20 minutes, the nation that is behind will have no time to catch up. And I say, let America never fall behind in maintaining the defenses necessary for the strength of this nation. I have no choice in my decisions but to come down on the side of security, because history has dealt harshly with those nations who have taken the other course. And so in that spirit, to the members of this graduating class, let me offer this credo for the defenders of our nation. I believe that we must balance our need for survival as a nation with our need for survival as a people. Americans, soldiers, and civilians must remember that defense is not an end in itself. It is a way of holding fast to the deepest values known to civilized men. I believe that our defense establishment will remain the servant of our national policy of bringing about peace in the world, and that those in any way connected with the military must scrupulously avoid even the appearance of becoming the master of that policy. I believe that every man in uniform is a citizen first and a serviceman second, and that we must resist any attempt to isolate or separate the defenders from the defended. We can prefer the flatteries of hope to the gloom of despair, but we cannot survive in the real world if we plan our defense in a dream world. I believe we must take risks for peace, but calculated risks, not foolish risks. We shall not trade our defenses for a disarming smile or charming words. We are prepared for new initiatives in the control of arms in the context of other specific moves to reduce tensions around the world. I believe that America is not going to become a garrison state or a welfare state or a police state simply because the American people will defend our values from those forces, external or internal, that would challenge or erode them. And I believe this above all, that this nation shall continue to be a source of world leadership, a source of freedom, strength in creating a just world order that will bring an end to war. Members of the graduating class and your colleagues in the academy, a president shares a special bond with the men and women in the nation's armed forces. He feels that bond strongly at moments like these, facing all of you who have pledged your lives, your fortunes, and your sacred honor to the service of your country. And he feels that bond most strongly when he presents the Medal of Honor to an 8-year-old boy who will never see his father again. Because of that bond, let me say this to you. In the past generation, since 1941, this nation has paid for 14 years of peace with 14 years of war. The American war debt of this generation has been far greater than all of the preceding generations in American's history. In terms of human suffering, this has been the costliest generation in the 2 centuries of our history. Perhaps this is why my generation is so determined to to pass on a different legacy. We want to redeem that sacrifice. We want to be remembered, not as the generation that suffered in war, but as the generation that was tempered in its fire for a great purpose, to make the kind of peace that the next generation will be able to keep. This is a challenge worthy of the idealism which I know motivates every man who will receive his diploma today. I am proud to have served in the armed forces of this nation in a war which ended before the members of this class were born. It is my deepest hope and my belief that each of you will be able to look back on your military career with pride, not because of the wars in which you have fought, but because of the peace and freedom which your service will make possible for America and the world.
President Richard Nixon, completing his speech at Falcon Stadium at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. The president is scheduled in a moment to receive a class gift from the cadet colonel, John W. Martin, Jr., and then he is to pass out diplomas to 47 of the most distinguished graduates of this year's class at the Air Force Academy. Cadets standing and applauding at the end of the president's speech.
President Nixon, on behalf of the class of 1969 and all the members here, the Academy personnel, I wish to express to you and to your family our deepest appreciation for your visit this morning. I want to assure you, Mr. President, that these young American men seated in front of you, my fellow classmates, are ready, willing, and very eager to serve you and our fellow citizens of the United States. At this time, sir, I would like to make a presentation. President Nixon, it is my great honor to present this saber plaque to you in appreciation for your visit here and to make you an honorary member of the finest class ever, the class of 69.
Commander Martin, I express my grateful appreciation for this symbol, which will be an eloquent reminder to us of this magnificent day. We will take it back to the White House, where all can see what the Air Force Academy and those who graduate from it mean to the United States of America. And I've been trying to think of something that would be appropriate other than words to reciprocate for this splendid gift, which the members of the class, I understand, have contributed to. And it just happened that I brought something from Washington from me. It's not a check. Maybe you'd better open it.
The White House, Washington. Amnesty for Air Cadets. Whereas it is customary and traditional that a visiting head of state at the United States Air Force Academy grant reprieve to those cadets who unfortunately are required to perform extra duty or suffer punishment for violation of United States Air Force Academy regulations, and whereas it is now desired that amnesty be granted on the occasion of this state visit to the United States Air Force Academy, Therefore, I do proclaim amnesty for all cadets who have committed minor violations of the United States Air Force Academy regulations. Signed, Richard Nixon.
A traditional thing, and perhaps the most popular that the president could have done, proclaiming amnesty for all those with minor violations.